Good morning.
Good morning, Maya.
Happy Dogen's birthday. Heard somebody out in the street there just a second ago say something like, do you remember that quote? I thought, maybe he's talking to me. What came to my mind is one of our many old Zen sayings. And this one is, if you fall in love with the road, you may not reach home. I think this is sometimes a problem for us. It's a pretty nice road, although difficult at times. But if one fetishizes the journey, we may forget to arrive. And yes, there's a little story about this. But first, I wanted to mention something that I recently ran across. There's a scientist named Bernardo Castro. Does that ring a bell, anybody? Yes. I hadn't heard of him, I don't think, before just a few weeks ago. Very striking looking. He has this enormous head. It's like full of brains, obviously. He's extremely smart. I'm not sure exactly what his main field is, but he seems to be able to talk about almost anything. But his current thinking seems to be around consciousness. And he is one of a, I think, growing group of people whom I like. They're the ones who say, consciousness is not produced by the brain. Although, of course, there's a bunch of people on the other side who say, oh, yes, it is. But they're not the ones who impress me, I must admit. And Dr. Castro, on this video I was watching, said, well, a lot of people assume that consciousness is in your head. But, says he, I do not see it that way. I am convinced that your head is in consciousness. And consciousness is essentially a universal and unlimited field. So I hadn't heard it put quite that way before, and I found it quite striking. And I also found it quite familiar. Here's another little tidbit. I was listening to one of the podcasts I follow. Let's see, which one was this? Oh, it was Fresh Air. So you may have heard the radio version. And Terry Gross was interviewing a gentleman whose name, of course, I've forgotten. He's the author of a book on psychedelic uses in, therapy and other contexts. And this is basically the history thereof. So going back into the 50s and 40s and before. And a couple of things that came up in this podcast struck me. One's not so important, but the author who was talking with Terry Gross said he was describing how the great anthropologist Gregory Bateson and the other great anthropologist, oops, Margaret Mead. This must mean something. What? They had some involvement in early days with the use of psychedelics. And Bateson, in particular, spent some time working as a person with security clearance in the US government and looking for ways that psychedelics and also hypnosis could be employed in interrogation, which was a little shocking. Gregory Bateson, as you know, was a pal of Zen Center in the early days. His wife, too, one of his wives, Lois Bateson, whom I remember, a very pleasant woman. He actually died at the Zen Center, what was then the quote guest house, unquote. And then he said, among the other people involved in this study was, he said, quote, the hypnotist Milton Erickson, unquote, or a hypnotist named Milton Erickson. I thought, how could you only have heard of Milton Erickson as, quote, a hypnotist? So some of you who are in mental health know that his impact on psychotherapeutic practice in the 1950s was enormous and continues to this day, actually, in some respects. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. But one of the other striking notions that came, I don't know, I guess from this podcast was that according to substantial experimentation, the use of psychedelics, which I think many of us, including me, for years assumed activates, some facets of the brain in some substantial fashion. This turns out not necessarily to be true. And in fact, the most recent experiments indicate that under the influence of psychedelics, the activity in the brain decreases markedly. So I thought that is fascinating. So you don't take, mushrooms or something and then get high and your brain gets all buzzy. It's, no, the brain quiets down. And these phenomena we associate with psychedelic experience occur in a field, a mental body mind field that is actually quieter than usual. And I thought, yeah, I bet that's right. And I bet that's why meditative practice also. Markedly and obviously, at some point, quiets the body mind. This actually permits other, I don't know, let's say, modes of perception. So you can probably see I am tempted to tie all of this together in some not so neat little package, but it makes eminent sense to me. First of all, that body mind is in consciousness, not gives rise to the meat puppet does not come up with consciousness. But consciousness buoys up the meat puppet into this remarkable field. And that when the body mind is quieter, certain ways of perceiving life and the universe start to offer themselves, let's put it that way. So this is why during retreat, eventually, the being able to rely completely on some already established schedule where, you know, people will feed you and you have a place to sleep and you can, you know, bathe if you need to, and et cetera, et cetera. All that's taken care of. You don't have to worry about any of that. And under those circumstances, and with the support of sitting in such a way that invites the body mind to be quiet. Many people have commented at the end of retreat, which, you know, sounds like it has this exhausting schedule, but they find they have all this energy. It's like, where did this come from? And then not only that, a certain aspects of our life or our existence began to seem quite straightforward and true in a way that did not require any argument or back and forth. It simply was so. So these are associations with retreat that I think will be familiar to many. And I think even our empiricist examinations are starting to produce information that will render uncomfortable those who are determined to be materialist. So the ground under their feet is eroding slowly, at least as I see it. So there are these stories about not falling in love with the road. In some weird way, all our Zen stories are actually one story, but I won't get into that. Anyway, one of our, I guess I would say our cousin ancestors was named Yangshan, and he and his teacher, also the towering Tang Dynasty figure, Guishan Mingyo, they're regarded as the progenitors of one of the five houses, Chan, in the Guiyang lineage. And they're cousins of ours on that. Some would say faux genealogy that we like, or I like. Of course, pretty much all genealogies have that mythological aspect. And as we know, mythology is a legitimate and necessary part of our human life and experience, and not just something that primitive people indulge in. But anyway, Yangshan had a community and a monastic came to see him. And I imagine these stories as though I were a Hollywood movie producer, usually. So I actually see these people. And anyway, I imagine the two of them sitting more or less face to face in the abbot's room. And maybe Yangshan doesn't know this particular monastic so well, so he says, "Where are you from?" Monastic says, "Oh, I'm from such and such a province." Yangshan says, "Do you think of that place?" The monastic says, "I always think of it." Yangshan nods and says, "Well, what thinks is the mind. And what's thought of is the environment. And there are mountains, rivers, and forests, and cities, and walls, and tiles, and pebbles, and so forth. Now, if you reflect on that which thinks, are there so many things there?" And here, I imagine the monastic closes his or her eyes, and there's a lengthy silence. And then the monastic says, "When I get here, I don't see that anything is. Yangshan says gently, in my telling, "Well, that's all right for the stage of faith, but that is not yet the stage of the person." And at this point, the monastic's eyes fly open, and he's perhaps a little disappointed. So he says, "One of those things guaranteed to irritate, or anyway, amuse, the so-called teacher." And he says, "Don't you have some other way of helping people?" And Yangshan shakes his head and clucks his tongue and says, whether I do or don't have another way misses the point. I grant, he says, that you have a single mystery. You may don the robe and take the seat. But hereafter, see for yourself. Do you understand? I mean, after all, if in your experience of cultivation, you feel you have arrived at a place where there isn't anything, that's pretty cool, no? In fact, Master Yangshan says, I grant you have one mystery. I fear you may remain at the stage of faith. And what does that mean? Are we supposed to have faith in, I don't know, Buddha Dharma or practice or something? But that's just the point. The stage of faith is in something. Still a little bit out there. This is not what Yangshan is prepared to call the stage of the person. So he says basically, okay. You put on your okesa and go back to the zendo, but you better keep studying. Which suggests that maybe this monastic wasn't exactly Yangshan's student. But was maybe making the rounds, as people supposedly did, going here and there and checking their understanding. So maybe he left that visit with Yangshan a little disappointed. This, of course, is a story from our favorite, or my favorite, collection of campfire tales, the Book of Serenity, number, I forget, 32 or something.
Yeah.
And naturally, our great ancestor, Jentong Gongzhi, who collected those stories, wrote a poem. It's a very interesting poem in which you can see it's kind of this back and forth between perhaps the stage of faith and the stage of the person. He says, all embracing with no outside, penetrating thoroughly with no obstruction. Gates and walls like cliffs. Doors and locks redoubled. The wine is sweet, but it flattens the guests. The feast is rich, but it ruins the farmers. Bursting out of a clear sky, a Garuda takes wing on the wind. Treading over the blue ocean, thunder follows a roaming dragon. I don't know if you can see this person. Bathe. Person. Bathe. Maybe you can. In a way, this story is about not falling in love with the road, beautiful though it is, but to keep going. Sometimes there is really too much emphasis on being able to say, I have arrived, or even better, someone else can say, oh, you have arrived. It's even more fun. But if you're actually home, no one needs to say that. Home, after all, is where the heart is. Fortunately, I usually can't talk too long because sitting in Padmasana is too uncomfortable. I'm not usually inclined to be long-winded anyway, but since I still seem to have a little mileage, if you have some question or comment, please. Yes.
I was just going to share. I had a couple of images pop in my head. We talked about sort of, I guess, maybe manifesting or creating or something, consciousness from our brain. I had that thought about the, you know, Egyptians ripping out the brain in the embalming process, assuming that that was a useless.
Oh, yeah, out through the nose, yes.
That was a useless organ, thinking of these other things. For the, you know, the mechanics or the thought center of the body. And the other thought that came to my mind was, and I don't know why this always comes up when people talk about psychedelics, I was thinking about the Oracle Delphi on their three-legged stool, inhaling the gas.
Yeah.
And delivering, I guess, I thought it was always super accurate, I suspect it was a really vague.
Mysterious little, yeah, right. That's the thing about oracles, including the marvelous Oracle of Tibet, you know, the Nichung Oracle. You may maybe seen some of the remarkable videos that are on YouTube. Apparently, that's an extremely punishing job, and those oracles tend to die young as a result. But once they're under the influence of the deity, they'll eventually, you know, respond to the question, which is often from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and
it's my little voice.
And someone has to, someone who's like skilled with this has to like hear what they say and write it down and then kind of interpret it because it tends to be a little peculiar. But it's really cool to watch, I must admit. And occasionally somebody in the audience will get swept up in it and they'll start doing, you know, demonstrating possession on their part and making little pronouncements. Then monks have to run over and say, you know, calm down. The focus is on up there, all right? So, anybody else?
Yes. The other day I was trying to think about the relationship between awareness and consciousness. And I was thinking this body-mind is made up of form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness. What is it that's aware of those things? Does awareness arise out of consciousness and then look back upon itself? That seems like an eye looking at an eye, in a way.
Right.
So I'm just curious how that works.
Well, our great founder, Shakyamuni Buddha, would say, now, let's assume that you're actually looking at something that's happening in this body-mind. You won't be able to find anything that's not one of those five. So there isn't the five plus awareness. It's just those five. So those five are another manner of studying intimately the phenomena of this body-mind. So if you're experiencing something medicinal, like awareness, I think Buddha would say, look at that, analyze that experience, and see if you can come up with another thing. And if you can, I think my teacher still promises to give a bunch of money to someone who can do that. So by all means, let him know. Anyway, that's my understanding. Please correct me if you think I'm wrong. The Tibetans, you know, are great on this analysis business. It's like, analyze everything till you can't find anything left. It's a pretty great feat for the intellect.
Well, maybe I haven't spent enough time trying to observe that process, because just off the top of my head, it seems like the awareness is my awareness.
Yes.
I am aware of
right.
Birds in the sky, fish in the water, or whatever.
Right. But then if we analyze I, we just got the five. We can't find anything else, which is the point in a manner of speaking. Right? You all know the five, right? Rupa, Vedana, Sunya, Samskara, Vijnanam. The tangible, the concrete, sensation. People say feelings, but no. Sensation, conception, or conceptualization, the impulsion for her way and consciousness. That's all. Yes.
So how do we measure our progress in the practice?
Well,
because, you know, there's a bunch of teachings like efforts and energy. Mm-hmm. But that implied it's some sort of progress. And then everything changes.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And there's no I and all these paradoxical concepts and philosophy.
Yeah.
But then we want to measure.
Yeah.
Like energy wise.
Yes.
Because we don't want to have stagnant. But being there sitting and then mm-hmm. you actually ended up looping.
Well, I would say a couple of things. One is sangha is important in that. It's one aspect. The teacher can be a big help. But also, I always remember being at Tassajara in the winter of 82, and Thich Nhat Hanh was there at the invitation of the then abbot, Zen Tatsu. And somebody asked basically that question. And Thay said, he's kind of like, I really shouldn't answer this because you shouldn't worry about that. If you trust Buddha Dharma, there will be progress. But there are a couple of things that happen to us as we practice Dharma. One is, as time passes, we become less fearful of death. That's one thing. And another thing is that compassion seems to arise spontaneously more and more. So these are two relatively simple little facets. And maybe we shouldn't worry about too much beyond that if we're actually trusting the Buddha way. Oh, are there hands there in the stratosphere?
There is one with Jim, it looks like.
Oh, yes, Jim, sorry. The hand is almost off screen there, but please speak.
Thank you. You sit two periods in the morning, don't you?
Not anymore.
Oh, I see. Well,
we may agree.
For years, often now, I've sat two periods in the morning. And when you were talking, what occurred to me is maybe this is a little droll or something, but the first period is the stage of faith. The second period is the stage of the person.
If so, carry on, like Yangshan said.
It's a third period.
Nothing beyond the first two.
Round and round. Well, maybe we can have our little birthday celebration. It's very simple. We just make some offerings, recite the harmony of difference and equality. And then we have even more goodies for you to eat upstairs. So please stay if you can. In any case, please take care. Thank you very much.
This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.